This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this lovely Saturday morning on February 18th, 2023. And we continue to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, although it appears that we're starting to see a gradual decline in the number of positive cases, at least here in Connecticut. That number has dropped to this week it was 6.8%, so say roughly 7%. So it seems that each week it's dropping by a percentage point. And I think that we're attributing this primarily to the effects of the people getting vaccinated, those who do get vaccinated, and those who have already had COVID and survived, obviously, and have built up an immunity. So it's gradually coming down, but still here. And hopefully, as we move on towards the spring and people are outdoors more, we'll start to see those numbers drop even more. One of the things we're dealing with now and you're hearing about is the norovirus. Now, the norovirus is a pretty common virus that we deal with. I guess it's the dreaded virus if you're on a cruise ship. You know how you always hear about these cruise ships where everybody developed GI problems on the cruise ship and they had to come home? So a norovirus is a virus that attacks the gastrointestinal system. So nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, those are the symptoms. And it's not transmitted, though, from a respiratory standpoint. So a mask isn't going to help you with norovirus. It's something you come in contact with and then have contact with your mouth. So the key here in protection is being very careful about washing your hands and using Purell. I think that many of us have gotten into the habit now of using Purell or any other antiseptic now if we don't have water available, probably from COVID as a carryover. So again, really hand washing and really overall sanitation are the keys to keeping the norovirus numbers down. It has been announced that on May 11th, the emergency status, the federal emergency surrounding COVID, is going to change. Now, what does that mean overall? What it means is that vaccines are not going to be free of charge anymore. The government's not going to pick up the tab on the vaccinations. Now, typically, these are covered. First of all, if you have Medicare or Medicaid, they will still be paid for by the government as part of your plan. There's part of, in Medicare, the case is part of the insurance plan you paid into. But for others, it's really up to your insurance company. Now, most insurance companies will pay for vaccination, especially, for example, the flu vaccine and things such as that. But you need to check with folks. So when it comes time, I'm not saying if, when it comes time that we need to get a booster, probably in the fall, we want to make sure your insurance company or your employer will be picking up whatever extra cost there is, because it's not inexpensive, to say the least. So with that, ask that question to make sure. And the other thing is test kits are not going to be available free of charge anymore from the government after May 11th. So those are things to keep in mind as we deal with this. And I'll have more information as we get closer to that date. Now, many of you are hearing in the past week that actor Bruce Willis has now been diagnosed with a condition called frontotemporal dementia. Previously, Bruce Willis was described as developing aphasia. And most likely the condition then was what we call primary progressive aphasia, which is an inability, when we think of aphasia, it's an impairment of the ability to use or understand language. So you can imagine that it's an inability to process the information someone is telling you in the state of a command and your ability to speak and respond. So primary progressive is a serious problem. But now they have changed the label to frontotemporal dementia, which is kind of a misnomer from the standpoint that, so frontotemporal dementia is a form of dementia that's different from Alzheimer's disease. It is often, usually the earliest symptoms are behavioral abnormalities because it affects the frontal lobes. So there's a lack of good judgment, lack of inhibition, people acting inappropriate socially, a lack of interest, apathy. So things such as that you'll see, and often they're mistaken for a psychiatric problem or even Alzheimer's disease. But again, it usually affects people between the ages of 40 and 65 for the most part. One of the subsets of frontotemporal dementia is the temporal part. So the behavioral part coming from the frontal lobe, the speech part coming primarily from the temporal lobe. So primary progressive aphasia is really just a form of frontotemporal dementia. This is a severe problem for one for which we have no treatment. And it is sad because it does progress and does affect people who are quite young and who also don't have other medical problems necessarily. It's one of the issues with dementia. It doesn't affect the heart, lungs, and vital organs. So with that, we will remember someone who's a great actor and really entertained us so much over the years, and wish his family well. February 18th, so this day in 1896, Dr. André Breton, he was a French-born physician and had a special interest in mental diseases. He was the principal founder of a school in psychological thought called Surrealism. And now we've all used that term, right? We said, well, I was in a situation and it seemed surreal. So surrealism was really a system where the unconscious mind allows you to allows itself to be expressed. So you often see this in visual arts or literature or film or music. So surreal, almost a dreamlike state. So Dr. Breton was among the first people to describe that on this day in 1896. One of the things I definitely did want to speak about today was something I came across and a new way of dealing with penicillin allergies. And I found this fascinating because so many people are labeled as having a penicillin allergy. And the problem with that is that penicillin allergy also applies to cephalosporin antibiotics. So Keflex and the other Ceftin, things that sound like that, those are cephalosporins. And what they're in a category of beta-lactam drugs. So if you're allergic to penicillin, there's an assumption that you're also allergic to the cephalosporins. So that means that when you have an infection, you need to go to a higher level of antibiotic. The higher level you need to go to, the more risk of complication, diarrhea, fatigue, and things like that. But we often think that that's the only way to defeat the infection. So what they're doing now is, and I didn't realize this, many people are diagnosed with penicillin allergies in childhood, and they truly have an allergy to the antibiotic. But what we've found is that typically within 10 years of birth, most people lose that penicillin allergy. So it's something that you can grow out of, but people go on their whole life being labeled as having a penicillin allergy. So what they're doing at the University of Michigan, and I assume other institutions as well, is working with patients to find out if they still have an allergy to penicillin. So what they will do is they'll do a skin test like you usually do for most allergies. And or what they'll do is give someone a test dose of penicillin after they've done the skin test. And then they have them sit in the office and monitor them every 15 minutes for an hour to see if they develop anaphylaxis, right? Difficulty breathing, a rash. And obviously, if they do, they can give them an antihistamine or epinephrine if needed, an EpiPen. But what they're finding is an overwhelming number of people no longer carry the label of penicillin allergy. And this can have long-lasting effect in your medical history. So if you have been labeled as having a penicillin allergy because of an allergy you developed when you were young, I suggest you talk to your primary care physician and try to find out how you can possibly be tested with penicillin and monitored appropriately so that we can get around this in some way and really open up a whole new category of medications that would help you. With that, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to get right to my guest today, Dr. Swarup Kumar. Dr. Kumar is an oncologist at the Carol and Ray NEAG Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Connecticut. And I'm having him on because if you've noticed, in the last few weeks, we've been tackling some really broad topics in medicine, right? So we talked about cardiology. We talked about ophthalmology. So we looked at these really broad topics. And this is another broad topic among the broadest. We're going to talk about cancer today. And I mentioned it last week on last week's show, so I've got some questions to put to him. But also, if you have questions for me that you'd like me to address on the air for Dr. Kumar, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. So we're going to take a short break. Now we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Swarup Kumar. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. It's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. A question that just came in apropos to something I mentioned about paying for vaccination or the booster. And the prices are interesting. So the federal government bought 105 million doses of the booster from Pfizer for about $30.48 a dose, whereas 66 million doses of Moderna's version was purchased for $26 a dose. Now, what they're saying, the speculation, is that once the emergency expires in May, the price could go as high as $110 to $130 per dose. So not inexpensive, nor was it inexpensive to produce, but a great question. So my guest today, who is with us, is Dr. Swarup Kumar. Dr. Kumar is an oncologist. He is a medical doctor specializing in cancer diagnosis and treatment at the Carol and Ray NEAG Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Connecticut. Swarup, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for taking time. So let's talk a little bit. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and training to become an oncologist?
Absolutely. As Tony's saying out, I started in medical school in India about 10, 11 years ago when I started this journey. And then once I finished my medical school, I went to a residency in Massachusetts that was training in internal medicine. And post completion of medicine training, I came here to UConn Health to do my fellowship in oncology, and have since decided to stay on. So about 10 to 12 years of this journey all along, and now I practice at the university as an assistant professor in oncology.
Swarup, an interesting thing over time, oncology has become a much sought-after fellowship to get after internal medicine. And you know, when I was originally starting out many years ago, it was not that sought after. Do you think it's more sought after now because that it's a more hopeful specialty in the sense of treatments available and it's become so vast? I just It's interesting how it's transitioned from one that was an easy fellowship to get to one that is among the most competitive of all.
Yeah, that's very true in a way, Tony, because back in the day, like, a lot of patients who were getting diagnosed with cancer really had not much of a hope. I mean, to talk about a few different cancers, maybe blood cancer had some better treatment options than others. And, you know, people were stuck in this cycle of, like, am I going to help this person out? Am I going to make a difference in this patient's care? So I think, speaking of from where we started and to now where we are, there's been a lot of change and revolution that has happened in cancer care. A lot of different modalities of treatment have come out that we are using now. So all of that has really kind of like made an impact on the education itself. And not only this, I think the way we practice oncology has also changed. A lot of care was given to patients while they were in the hospital, being admitted. And now we have the option to do that in the outpatient, where we could see folks in the clinic, administer treatment right then and there. So now we have pill-based treatment. We didn't have that before.
Sure.
So having that kind of option kind of now being available has certainly attracted a lot of individuals to focusing on this treatment.
So, Arp, how would you define cancer? I mean, it's such a general term. And, I mean, you already mentioned blood cancers and, you know, there are so many different types of cancers. In a short summary, how would you define cancer and the types for our listeners?
So I see cancer as a disease process that changes the way your body behaves, and one that is unchecked and one that grows without, like, having our body control the outcome. So, and of this, there are different types and varieties. And, you know, as you even think of the word cancer, you know, it's akin to a crab with, like, different arms. So cancer can go into different areas. It can be of different subtypes. We have blood cancers, as I just mentioned. We have breast cancer, lung cancer. There's several different types depending on where these cells originate from.
Among the cancers, where have we made the most progress, do you think?
My sense is that, you know, a lot of progress initially happened in the field of blood cancers, because for some reason, you know, we always have found it easier to access tissue by drawing a blood sample. So if you think about 50s and 60s, we had chemotherapy options that were emerging. We had bone marrow transplants that had come up. So a lot of initial treatments were targeted at blood cancers. However, now with the advent of immune therapy, where we've been able to tune the immune system to attack cancer, we've made a lot of progress in other types of cancers, what we call solid cancers that originate in the breast, lung, prostate, liver, et cetera.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, sometimes people say, why don't they find a cure for cancer? And they don't understand that it's a real spectrum of disease. And it's interesting you mentioned the blood cancers because, again, early on, we knew we could treat Hodgkin's disease, right? Hodgkin's lymphoma was, you know, one of the earlier treatable cancers, blood cancers. So we're going to take a short break. And then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Swarup Kumar. If you have questions for Dr. Kumar regarding cancer, and I have some other questions that were sent in, you can reach us live on the air at info@alessimd.com. We'll take a short break, and then we're going to be back with him. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Oh, when you're smiling.
We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. In this part of our program, we're going to continue with my guest, Dr. Swarup Kumar. And Dr. Kumar is an oncologist at the Carolyn Ray NEAG Comprehensive Cancer Center at UConn. If you wish to reach out to see Dr. Kumar, the best phone number is 860-679-2100. During the break, we had an interesting question. Lori got in touch with me with this one, and that is, when does a physician decide to just follow an incidental finding, say in the kidneys or lungs? and she reported that she had relatives who have these so-called lesions, and it's been decided to follow them along as opposed to initiating treatment or getting biopsies. And in her case, there was an incidental finding, ended up being cancer itself. But, you know, it's an interesting question, and I'm going to get Dr. Kumar's opinion on that. I'll give you mine first, because in neurology, now that we have MRIs, we're often seeing a lot of things we couldn't see before. And many of those things, people just took to the grave with them, specifically multiple sclerosis. You might see a demyelinating lesion, but is that multiple sclerosis? Is the patient functioning fine? I mean, you always treat the patient and not necessarily the image, at least in neurology. So in many cases, if I see a, quotes, lesion, and there's no clinical implication, I will often follow it along rather than start somebody on treatment right away. But Swarup, what do you think with a question like that when it comes to cancer, incidental findings? When do you start putting on the full court press?
Yeah, this is a really an excellent question put forth. And I think this is something that we deal with on a regular basis. And of course, if you look at it from a broader perspective, incidental is really incidental in different ways.
Yeah.
Now we start doing more blood tests and we pick up a lot more things than we wouldn't have picked up in the future. The same holds for radiology because things get done for different reasons and then we pick up things. And this is where you have to understand cancer is really heterogeneous. There are some cancers and these cancers in some people may move very, very, very slowly. In some others, they may not. And I think it depends on a lot to do with what exactly is the finding. And, you know, sometimes monitoring gives us a clue as to how this behaves. For an example, you know, PSA is a test, prostate antigen, that we do routinely for, you know, something that can help us with the diagnosis of prostate cancer. But if you start doing that and folks who are in their 80s or 90s, that test is not really helpful because prostate cancer also comes in different forms where, you know, it may just kind of like sit there and people, as you kind of pointed out, Tony, they may not even get diagnosed, you know, maybe until nature takes its course or something else happens to them. So it's really a combination of like what exactly is that finding and the length of monitoring and based upon our prior knowledge as to how these kind of diseases or cancers behave. We put forth a judgment as to whether we want to monitor or whether we want to biopsy or do other things.
Great, great question. I thank her for that. Let's talk a little bit about cancer treatments, because I think over the years we've seen the greatest evolution in terms of treatments. For example, radiation. I mean, I remember the old days where they used cobalt as radiation therapy, and people would have severe burns from getting lung lesions radiated and things like that. And we have so much now, chemotherapy, marrow transplants, stem cells, immunotherapy. Can you walk us through some of these treatments and how they really impact the treatment of cancer?
Absolutely. As you pointed out, these treatments and the science behind the cancer therapies has been there for the past so many years. But what has happened, though, is that you know, there was a lack in technology and, scientific instrumentation that was preventing us from harnessing the power of these treatments. So what started off as basic chemotherapy was, which was toxic to the bone marrow, toxic to the body, and also radiation, as you mentioned, you know, with a lot of side effects, has just evolved over the years into something that we can kind of tune towards just treating the cancer. And that's where different techniques and different types of treatment come in. More recently, what has been kind of what has been really promising in the treatment of cancer is immunotherapy, where simply we give drugs that tell the immune system to go and fight cancer. What was understood was the immune system was active in cancer, but it was just not targeted against the right things. And now we've been able to kind of like unlock the potential of the immune system by training these cells to go and fight cancer. And this is what is really interesting. And we see a lot of patients receiving these type of treatments who have really had remarkable improvements in their care.
What about bone marrow? We always hear about the bone marrow transplants for a different blood. How does that differ from stem cell treatments?
Yeah, absolutely. So bone marrow transplants are kind of akin to, so there's two ways in which bone marrow transplants work. So one in which we use our own body cells. First, we give a certain amount of high-dose chemotherapy. And once we knock off the cells in the body, you know, we return the person's stem cells back to them so they can kind of grow inside the body and repopulate. So that's something what we call autologous. And the other one is the more well-known form where we get cells from other individuals who are matched with the individual with cancer, and then these cells are given to these patients in the hope that, you know, with destruction of the cancer cell, the other person's cells might repopulate and prevent cancer from coming back. Bone marrow transplants have been there, again, for the past 30 or 40 years or so, but there's been a lot of improvisation and improvement, and right now, they aren't necessarily used as the first line for blood cancers. We generally reserve them if they fail certain chemotherapies or immunotherapy options, but it's still a really great option, which, you know, I think makes a difference in the field of blood cancers.
One of the things we did and was popular, and I don't know if it's still popular, is when my grandchildren were born, we retained and banked their cord blood in terms of having those cells available. Can you talk a little bit about that? First of all, was that worthwhile in doing something like that? I just saw it as potentially an insurance policy for my grandchildren. Is that still done, or is it worthwhile?
That is, an excellent question, Tony, that we just had a baby recently, and I went through the same process of thinking, is doing a cord blood, you know, storing the cord blood worth it or not?
Yeah.
And my opinion was, you know, after listening to and gathering as much data, really the incidence of blood cancers overall is low. But that being said, you know, cord blood seems to perhaps function in a way where you use it as a reserve. And when we do bone marrow transplants, we generally prefer transplant cells from other individuals over that of the cord blood itself. Sometimes the cord blood may not be enough, and you might need two sets of cord blood to be given. And the other challenge with cord blood is that there's no real standard of, like, regulating this. There's no, like, entity or organization that, you know, unlike that of other person's stem cells, where we can monitor and kind of, like, there's safety issues that kind of also persist with this. So in short, I think it's not something that I find it super useful or helpful, but of course can be kind of thought of as something in the future where people might be able to manipulate better.
Okay. All right. Let's get into really what your area of specialty is, multiple myeloma. Can you talk a little bit about what is multiple myeloma?
Yeah, multiple myeloma is a form of blood cancer, of which there are several types. You have leukemias, lymphomas, and myeloma is a form of blood cancer that affects individuals, bones in particular. It can rapidly kind of destroy bone architecture and result in fractures, things like that. It can also affect your blood counts. It can make you feel like more tired. It can cause bleeding issues, etc. And oftentimes, when patients come to me, or when we suspect multiple myeloma, the most common thing is we end up having done scans for some other reason, and we pick up these bone lesions. That is how they often present. And then when we run our blood tests, when we do biopsies, we found out that they have multiple myeloma. In short, it is a relatively rare blood cancer, but it is still debilitating because it's an incurable disease, for which there are several excellent treatment options now, which we utilize in our clinic, but something that patients often burn through, meaning folks often use or progress through multiple treatment lines without any end in sight.
Is it more common in men? Because I think that almost all the cases where I've, you know, diagnosed it, and I say people presented with neuropathy and other problems, and when we did the workup, we found that they had myeloma and had these lesions. But I don't know that I've ever found it in a woman.
Yeah, I would say to an extent it is more prevalent in men than in women, but we do see individuals of varying gender, of even of varying racial origin. I have to say that myeloma is a disease that predominantly has also been shown to affect the individuals of African-American descent. There seems to be a lot more myelomas that get diagnosed in this population. And the disease course is also so heterogeneous. Like, some people that get diagnosed are able to live relatively well for a long period of time, while others, their disease just kind of like progresses rapidly. So it's very heterogeneous in the way it affects people and what type of people, et cetera.
How much of it is genetic?
All of it is pretty much genetic, I would say. It's not necessarily a hereditary form of disease, but what some studies have shown that there seems to be some clustering in families. For example, if one family member get diagnosed with myeloma and we do our family history, we're able to see that happening in kind of like other family members as well. They have leukemias, they have myeloma. So there's some sort of clustering of cancers happening in families that we still haven't been able to kind of like, you know, study in detail.
You know, one of the things that you already mentioned, I guess, is the fact that these patients often present with fractures. I think in many cases, it's been people who presented with, you know, had a coughing spell or had pneumonia and then suddenly were fracturing ribs. Is that the most common way that you find it presents, or is it really incidental where someone went for an x-ray for something else and you picked up a lesion?
So I've seen different ways in which this disease presents, and you know, as you mentioned, fractures is one. Kidney failure is another one where I get a lot of referrals from nephrologists who monitor patients' kidney functions. And then when we do blood tests, we find out that they have myeloma. Same goes for incidental findings. The other aspect of screening for myeloma is we have a specialized clinic at UConn that assesses this condition called MGUS, which is basically a precursor state to myeloma. And, you know, something that is common in our population, about 5 to 10% of everyone over age 50 has MGUS. But then we speak to who is at risk for developing myeloma. And by really capturing patients early on, assessing their MGUS, we're able to predict and we're able to monitor them and kind of start treatment even before these fractures or other complications occur. Because what happens is in myeloma, once the patient already has bone damage, it takes a very, very long time for the damage to be repaired. So the earlier you start, the earlier you pick up patients, the better the outcomes are.
You touched on a topic near and dear to my heart, because actually in my fellowship in 1985, some of my original work was monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance with peripheral neuropathy. So we would find people with these dramatic demyelinating peripheral polyneuropathies and having a kappa gamma spike, gamma, and it was so interesting. I'm glad to see that there's been so much progress made over the last umpteen years.
Absolutely. I think we're recognizing more and more what MGUS does, and we now have a new entity called monoclonal gammopathy of clinical significance, really where we see patients being referred to us for neuropathy, for renal failure, for other issues. And this is just a complex field, and myeloma in general itself is also already heterogeneous. So the whole, and that's why we use an umbrella term called plasma cell disorders. The culprit here is really this plasma cell, a type of blood cell that exhibits a vast array of clinical issues, ranging anywhere from MGUS to myeloma, to amyloidosis, to neuropathy, There's a lot of different things that this cell can do.
Let's talk about some new treatments that you have available for multiple myeloma. Let's talk a little bit about those. You have something new, and I think we really wanted to make people aware of it.
Oh, yes. So, as I was mentioning, myeloma is such a heterogeneous disease, and most often patients go through at least 4 to 6 different treatment lines. That's on an average what an myeloma patient goes through. And what we've seen is while these early treatments work very well, what happens is that the disease kind of reoccurs quickly enough that we have to kind of move to another line of treatment. So it's like we're moving on from one treatment after another. And now there is this new treatment option called teclistamab, which is really a drug that, again, speaking about immunotherapies, works by making the immune system fight the myeloma cell. So this is a drug that is given and binds to the T cell, which is an immune system cell, and tells the T cell to fight the myeloma cell. And this drug is given on a recurring basis. Because this is something that we target the immune system or we train the immune system to fight, it takes about the first 10 days or so until a good enough concentration is reached. And this is a crucial time with this treatment because side effects can occur. We monitor patients closely in a hospital. And once they've kind of they've passed this initial phase, then they're on a more routine kind of schedule with the drug. And this is a treatment option that's available for patients who have had prior treatments for myeloma and have not responded. And really, we're seeing kind of excellent, robust responses with this treatment, which is something that we have never seen before.
You know, I find it interesting because when you're talking about immunotherapy, we're talking about vaccines, right? We're talking about essentially creating a vaccine against a cancer. And I just found it interesting to see all these people, you know, protesting getting the COVID-19 vaccine. Oh, I don't want anything touching my immune system or anything like that. But I can guarantee you that if they were faced with multiple myeloma and the opportunity for immunotherapy or of a vaccine to get rid of their cancer, this would be the way to go. And because your side
Absolutely.
Effects are relatively minimal, am I correct?
Yes, that is true. As I said, the initial part is where the side effects are common. Because if you think about immunotherapies, what they're doing is they're trying to mimic an infection in the body.
Right.
So by trying to mimic an infection, you develop fevers, you develop a sepsis kind of picture, which is something we're all trained in monitoring or trained in managing. So if we can get past this phase, which we have been able to successfully do so, then these treatments have, you know, a really good kind of like outcome for patients. So I see a lot of potential for this drug and several others that are in development to come early in the treatment of myeloma. So the earlier we can use these robust treatments, then we can avoid patients from going through multiple lines of treatment and getting tired out through their disease course.
Swarup, thank you. Thank you for your time today. And you know, we got into so many different topics. I'm going to have to get you back on at some point because there were topics we didn't get to. But thank you for all you do to help our patients with cancer at the University of Connecticut. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you for having me.
It was great to have that. And really, I hope everybody enjoyed kind of a global discussion of cancer today. I thank people who reached out with questions. Now, many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board today. Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. We'll be back live again next week, chatting about probably another broad topic. We're going to work on that this week and get a guest on. If you have questions for me during the week, you can always reach out at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program and you wish to hear more about it or refer it over to somebody else, you can do that by getting the Healthy Rounds podcast downloaded from Audacy.com or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Many thanks again to my guest, Dr. Kumar, today. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.